Nuclear reactor embrittlement. That's what happens when a nuclear containment vessel, you know, that thing that's supposed to keep the radioactive materials created by splitting the atom to make heat, to boil water, to make steam, to run generators, to create electricity, otherwise known as the most expensive and dangerous method on Earth for boiling water. A nuclear containment vessel gets hit with years, decades, of bombardment from radioactive particles and becomes, well, brittle, and prone to breaking and spewing dangerous levels of radiation into the environment and, in addition, onto you. Embrittlement is grounds for a nuclear reactor being permanently shut down. So, of course, the nuclear industry does everything in its power to distract people from this ongoing danger. That's what's been happening at the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Station in San Luis Obispo, California. And because the nukesters won't listen to arguments from mere self-educated, genuine experts who happen to be local residents, a local group hired a credentialed, highly respected materials engineer expert to examine the data and issue his response. And that's when you learn...
He is pro-nuclear, but he started reading all of this material and he said, oh my God, this is true. This reactor vessel probably ran out of its viability. Well, he said 2024, give or take 10 years. That means it might have been too embrittled back in 2014. And that we may have been running this thing all along with a reactor vessel that's like a hand grenade.
A time bomb,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, when Linda Seeley of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace tells you what that pro-nuclear, internationally respected materials engineer had to say about Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Station and its quote-unquote safety, you get a really clear picture of how close we are to that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we piggyback on a fabulous Zoom call put together by the esteemed Harvey Wasserman, veteran anti-nuclear activist who coined the term no nukes. We listen in on the conversation as Harvey talks with Linda Seeley of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace about problems at the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors in Northern California. And then he talks with Kevin Camps, nuclear waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, about what's wrong with the proposed restart of the Palisades nuclear reactor in Michigan. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than you'll hear about in the entire state of Florida. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, September 19, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out, we touch on two stories that will be covered in today's feature. In the first, at Diablo Canyon in Northern California, Mothers for Peace and Friends of the Earth are demanding an immediate shutdown of Diablo Canyon's Unit 1 and a hearing to address the decades-long delay in inspecting and testing the pressure vessel. And in Michigan, plans are afoot to restart the shuttered Palisades nuclear generating station near Detroit. Of course, since this is such a bad idea, you know that Holtec is the company that is involved. Again, this is something we will hear much more about during today's feature. In the Southwest, the city of Fort Worth, Texas, and the state of New Mexico together both filed Friends of the Court briefs in support of Beyond Nuclear and other federal appeals against the Holtec International, there's that name again, high-level radioactive waste facility targeted at southeastern New Mexico. Shipments of irradiated nuclear fuel to Holtec's facility would heavily impact the Fort Worth area, which is a major rail hub. Beyond Nuclear and others have pursued federal appeals on this for many years, but the case has been held in abeyance until the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission approved the construction and operating license, which happened on May 9, 2023. Note that a comparable high-level waste storage facility in West Texas has been disallowed with the license overturned by the 9th District Court. That story was featured on last week's Nuclear Hot Seat number 638, the Good News episode. Also in New Mexico, the New Mexico Environment Department has rejected the Los Alamos National Laboratory's plans for so-called cleanup through cap and cover, which is basically just a nuclear version of sweeping it under the rug. Los Alamos's plan would leave existing radioactive and toxic wastes uncharacterized and forever buried in unlined pits and trenches as a permanent threat to groundwater. And now, the New Mexico Environment Department has said, nuh-uh, you gotta do much better than that, and determined that the cleanup must consist of waste excavation, characterization, and appropriate disposal in a manner that does not pose a significant risk to workers. We'll link to the press release, which is quite glorious, and it comes from nukewatch.org. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
I had planned to do a Numbnuts on the fact that the big story out of Fukushima, according to the Japan Times, is that they can't find young umpires to work with the local baseball teams. Big, important Fukushima story, right? But they have been totally eclipsed by the U.S. Congress. Apparently, if we oppose the release of the radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima, that means, perforce, we're pro-China. So to get that point across, the U.S. House Select Committee on Chinese Communist Party opened its latest volley against Beijing at a sushi and sake night on Capitol Hill, co-hosted by the Japanese Embassy in Washington. Why am I not surprised? China is one of several countries to criticize Japan's decision to start releasing around 30 years of radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, a process which was begun on August 24th. China reacted by immediately banning all imports of Japanese seafood into the country over safety concerns. But does that deter our yuck-yuck experts in Congress? Heck no. Mike Gallagher, a Republican of Wisconsin and chairman of the committee, called Beijing's actions, quote, nothing more than economic coercion directed at Japan designed to hurt Japan's economy. And their feelings, too. Boo-hoo. Gallagher says that China's ban was, quote, built on a foundation of falsehoods. Yeah, that's a great industry talking point with no footnotes. He cites the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying that the treated water would have negligible impact on people and the environment, and that Japan's actions were, quote, consistent with relevant international safety standards. Yeah, the IAEA would say that because they're the ones who set those standards, and they set them way too high for safety and have been criticized for it for years. While Greenpeace Japan and U.S.-based National Association of Marine Laboratories have raised concerns, noting limited radiological data disclosures and uncertain long-term effects. In other words, science. But that did not deter the repug Gallagher saying, they don't know what they're missing right now, as he gestured to plates of sushi spread out before him. Oh yes, we do know what you're missing. So they're framing it as those who oppose the water release from Fukushima are lovers of China and against our democratic right to eat radioactively contaminated fish. And that's why Gallagher, no, not the one who smashes watermelons with a mallet, but you might as well be. You, Representative Gallagher, are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
That bridges us into the news from Japan, where that country is set to release 3 more batches of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from its crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant by next March. This according to the South Korean government. Beginning on August 24th of this year, Japan and operator Tokyo Electric Power Company released 780 liters of what they call treated water that is still contaminated with tritium, meaning it's radioactive. Japan likes to claim that, quote, no abnormalities have been detected in terms of concentration levels of tritium. But dude, it was just released on August 24th. That's a month ago. You're not going to see major changes in such a short period of time. Pretending that this proves anything is just nonsense and media manipulation. Here's another manipulation of the optics. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, has agreed with Japan on its continuous safety review of discharged radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater from Fukushima Daiichi. Meanwhile, China's embassy in Japan has repeatedly said that it was not invited to take part in the international framework to monitor the water from the Fukushima plant, which it calls contaminated. An assessment with which Nuclear Hot Seat agrees. Because China has canceled all seafood and fish purchases from Japan, Prime Minister Kishida has unveiled a relief package for the fishery sector of that country. Among the moves being taken to, quote, mitigate reputational damage is finding new overseas markets to sell the fish and diversifying seafood sales channels. In addition to China canceling all imports of fish and seafood from Japan, Hong Kong, which is a semi-autonomous region of China, has banned seafood imports from Tokyo, Fukushima, and 8 other prefectures in Japan. China has also called for the attention of the United Nations Human Rights Council regarding Japan's release of the radioactive water, with Chen Zhu, head of the Chinese mission to the UN at Geneva, saying that if the Fukushima nuclear-contaminated water is truly safe, Japan wouldn't have to dump it into the ocean, and certainly shouldn't if it's not. There's an important article entitled, "The Discharge of Fukushima's Radioactive Water Could Be a Precedent for Similar Actions." It's written by one of our favorite journalists, Pinar Demirjan, who is based in Turkey. It's up on the Dianuke site, and we will have a link to it up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 639. And in what I'm going to have to start calling the Pinocchio Report, Tokyo Electric Power Company has reported to Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority its assessment that the reactor at Fukushima Daiichi can be supported and will not topple over even under the assumption of a maximum earthquake. Upon receiving the report, the Nuclear Regulatory Authority pointed out that the detailed situation around the reactor is still unknown and that many parts of the report were based on hypothetical data. They have decided to continue discussions by requesting more detailed data on the grounds that the explanation of the evidence was insufficient. To be continued. Further international news, and this is great. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons announces that 2 more countries have just taken action under the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. The Bahamas has signed the agreement, and Sri Lanka has acceded. Their actions bring the tally of nuclear ban signatories to 93, close to half the countries in the world, and 69 state parties. In Ukraine, a leading engineer at the Soviet-era facility at Zaporizhia has warned that the chance of a serious disaster at the Ukrainian nuclear power plant occupied by Russia has risen to 1 in 5. According to one of the 10 most senior engineers at the plant near Zaporizhia, an exodus of top staff and the power station's use as a military base by Chechen troops are among the reasons why a Fukushima scenario could happen at any time. The shortage of expertise is so acute that janitors, secretaries, and blue-collar workers are posing as engineers in lab coats to dupe international observers into believing that the Russians have the necessary staff to avert disaster. The engineer, using the pseudonym Ivan, said, "I personally consider it a 10 to 20% likelihood of a serious emergency and a 50 to 60% chance that they will damage everything when they leave. And if there is a serious emergency meltdown in one or more of the six reactors, it will have similar but worse consequences to those of the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan." We'll have this week's feature in just a moment, but first, whenever the nuclear industry wants to get away with something, they have a massive media machine to make certain their talking points are the dominant ones. There are the soul-dead cubicle drones who write propaganda press releases and print-ready stories for World Nuclear News, favored reporters or talk show hosts to spread the word, manufactured op-eds, and an international reach, all backed by millions of dollars, where they place their perspective anywhere and everywhere they wish. Those who know the truth about nuclear and oppose this media manipulation have a tough, almost vertical uphill climb to get our perspective in front of the public. That's why now, more than ever, you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We're dedicated to presenting you with expert interviews that contradict nuclear industry propaganda talking points. We cover not only what the industry is doing, but how brave activists around the world are fighting back, and how any one of us can take action towards stopping the nuclear madness. We give you the nuclear stories you can't and won't find in mainstream media, and the stories behind those stories to provide you with context and continuity. But in order to keep doing so, we need your help because, hey, the bills have to be paid. This show runs on donations, and without them, we can't continue. So if you want Nuclear Hot Seat to keep going, we need your support now. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and that's how you can send us a one-time donation of any amount or set up a recurring donation, say the equivalent of a cup of coffee, which is $5 a month. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, which means your donations are tax deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or if you have Zelle, send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Donate now, and know that whatever you can do to help, you have my deepest gratitude. Now, here is this week's special feature. In coming back from a week off-grid and offline in the mountains, I realized that I was without an interview for this week's show. But before I could line one up, I realized that the esteemed Harvey Wasserman was already scheduling the exact interview that I wanted, and so much more. It took place during his regular weekly Zoom call for Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection, or GREEP, at grassrootsep.org. So in the spirit of recycling, in the best informational way possible, Harvey graciously offered me his show. So here is a conversation held on Monday, September 18, between Harvey Wasserman, Linda Seeley of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, and Kevin Camps, radioactive waste expert at Beyond Nuclear. But before we start, as activists often do, we throw around a lot of acronyms that we already know about, but you may not. So when you hear NRC, that's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. PG&E is Pacific Gas and Electric, the utility that owns and operates Diablo Canyon.
We're going to talk now with Linda Seeley for the Mothers for Peace. Linda has redrafted a petition that we circulated in 2019. What's happening at Diablo Canyon, the two reactors at San Luis Obispo, is that they will be shutting very soon. And Linda, correct me if I'm wrong about what's going on at Palisades.
One more thing I wanted to say, the petition, the Mothers for Peace, just began with the showings of our film. So let's make sure we cover all the bases here.
Okay, absolutely. And we're joined by with the great Joel Siegel from North Carolina. Joel, great to have you with us. We have 45 people on. Jim and Mary Beth, stay with us, please. And Kevin, we're going to get to you. We're going to talk now with Linda Seeley for the Mothers for Peace. Linda has redrafted a petition that we circulated in 2019. What's happening at Diablo Canyon, the two reactors at San Luis Obispo, is that they will be shutting very soon. and Linda, correct me if I'm wrong, for refueling. We don't know exactly when. They never tell us when, but we know it's going to be about 50 days. Now, in 2019, they shut San Onofre, Diablo Unit 1, and we petitioned. We had 2,400 people sign, and we know that the Governor Newsom read it, the petition, and just blew us off. And we didn't actually ask for Diablo to be shut. All we asked for was to be inspected. Which, you know, they can't get insurance and they can't get inspected. You know, you can't drive a car in California that's not insured or inspected, but I guess a nuclear plant that could kill a few million people, that's okay. So Linda, and you've been with the Mothers for Peace for God knows how long. Tell us in detail now. Tell us, Linda, what's going on with your petition and keep Diablo shut.
Thank you so much, Harvey. Mothers for Peace has been involved in trying to get Diablo Canyon shut down since before it opened in 1973 is when we started. We currently have three proceedings going on. Number one is a case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals about the timely renewal issue of the license to extend the operation of Diablo Canyon. The NRC violated its own rule, which is called the timely renewal rule, when they allowed PG&E to apply for a license extension only 10 months before Unit 1 is scheduled to shut down. That's completely against their rules. The rules state that it has to be 5 years prior to the scheduled expiration of a license. They've allowed another plant 3 years, 10 months is insane. Okay, that's the first thing we're involved in. The second thing is at the California Public Utilities Commission, where we are saying that Diablo Canyon is not economical, it's not safe because of earthquakes, because of the Unit 1 reactor vessel, and we have enough renewables to make up for Diablo Canyon right now. So don't let anybody tell you that we need Diablo Canyon because we need this carbon-free energy source. It's completely BS, okay? So what we're doing now, last Thursday, we filed a petition with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission because, think about, Harvey was just talking about it. We have two reactors just about 7 miles from my house. The Unit 1 reactor vessel was manufactured in 1967. And after they installed that vessel, they realized that some of the material that they put in there, namely copper and nickel, they had too much of those things in there. But they thought, no big deal. So now, after running it for almost 40 years, what's happened, because it's been under tremendous pressure, tremendous amounts of radiation have been, you know, given off inside of there. And it's really, really, really hot in there. And everything works fine as long as it's just everything is going along perfectly. The problem is that if we would have an earthquake at Diablo Canyon, and there happened to be 13 earthquake faults just in the very vicinity of it, and one of them runs straight under the reactor, and that one has recently been found to be what's called a thrust fault, meaning that if it went off, it would go up instead of sideways, and those things cause a lot more damage to structures. It's the one in Turkey was a thrust quake that killed so many people. So this reactor vessel, what happens is, like, if there's a problem, earthquake, act of malice, if there's some kind of screw up with one of the operators and they do something they shouldn't have done, which is what happened at Chernobyl, that's why that thing melted down. What they have to do is they have to pour a bunch of cold water into it to make it the nuclear reaction stop. It's called a cold shutdown. And if they have to do a cold shutdown in a reactor vessel like Unit 1, the chances are really good that the whole thing could shatter like a glass. And if that happens, there is no emergency backup safety net for the reactor vessel. if that would happen, it would be the worst thing that could happen in a nuclear power plant. So what happened is that
we... Let me jump in real quickly. What would happen, because we saw this at Fukushima, if the reactor pressure vessel shatters, God forbid, and God knows how hot it would be, you would have steam, which of course is highly volatile and expands in an explosive dimension. You would have hydrogen, which is also hydrogen is what caused the explosions at Fukushima, including Unit 4, which wasn't even operating at the time. So then you could indeed have fission and an actual nuclear bomb, which we think may have happened, and Kevin knows a lot about this, at Unit 3 at Fukushima, where there was a plutonium. So all of that could happen at Diablo Canyon if, God forbid, in an emergency situation, the pressure vessel would shatter. And that's why embrittlement is such a big issue. Because essentially, with an embrittled core, you're driving a car where if you put on the brakes, it explodes. That's actually not a good strategy for running a nuclear plant. So go ahead.
It's really bad strategy. Yeah. So what we had heard about this embrittlement issue back in 2007, when the NRC wrote a letter, and it was about Palisades, and Kevin will remember this, that they listed the most embrittled reactors in the fleet of reactors around the country. And Diablo Canyon was like number 5. And we're like, what? This is embrittled? Like, one of our citizen members of our community is an engineer, and he started digging into this issue last year, over a year ago. He read 4,000 pages of technical material. They have obfuscated this problem so deeply that it's almost impossible to reach. We couldn't understand these technical papers that had been written. And so we'd start reading them, our eyes would cross, and we went, look, we can't figure it out. But this guy, a friend, he's now become a friend, dug it out. And then we were able, Mothers for Peace were able, by a stroke of luck, to hire an expert witness who is one of the most, he's probably the most highly respected materials engineer in the whole country. His name is Digby McDonald, and he teaches at Berkeley. He is an illustrious materials scientist. And he is pro-nuclear, but he started reading all of this material, and he said, oh my God, this is true. This reactor vessel probably ran out of its viability. Well, he said 2024, give or take 10 years. That means it might have been too embrittle back in 2014. That we may have been running this thing all along with a reactor vessel that's like a hand grenade.
A time bomb,
yeah. And so we submitted a petition to the NRC last Thursday, along with Digby's testimony, and they have 25 days to respond to our petition. And what we have asked for is for them to have a hearing of the commission itself to consider this, and they will probably appoint a technical committee from the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board to review everything. I don't know that, but that's their customary thing. And Kevin, you can probably comment on that. And then also, of course, we're bringing it up in our case with the California Public Utilities Commission, because they're the ones who are giving out $1.4 billion to PG&E to keep a time bomb running. And so we want to cut that off to make sure that our state legislators know all about it, and that the Public Utilities Commission knows what's going on, so that they can have a chance to redeem themselves before they have to be blamed for a horrible possible accident in California.
So let's make sure people understand this is a very big deal. This petition, this lawsuit is in front of a federal court, the Ninth Circuit Court. And the law has been that the civil courts have no jurisdiction in the nuclear industry because of the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, but that veil needs to be pierced. There is precedent for this. In 1991, lightning struck the Yankee Row nuclear plant on the Deerfield River in Massachusetts, which at the time was among the oldest reactors in the country. I believe it had opened in 61, so it's 30 years old. And the owner of the nuclear plant, Yankee Atomic, was wanting to start it again. But we raised a movement in Western Massachusetts, and we got a hearing in Congress just as there was a changeover at the commissionership, the chairship of the NRC. And a congressperson from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, Peter Kostmeyer, in a hearing, told the incoming chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, his name was Ivan Selin, and I was sitting right next to him. I testified in the hearing, and there was me, and there was the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Come on, you know. Anyway, so Kostmeyer told Ivan Selin that he needed to make sure, and we raised the issue of embrittlement. It would not have become an issue without the citizen participation. And he told the chairman, incoming chairman of Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that they needed to have Yankee Row tested for embrittlement before it reopened. And there was a whole uproar, and we don't know to this day if Yankee Atomic had the capacity to test for embrittlement. There was discussion of they were going to have to take like an ice cream scooper and somehow carve out a piece of the a reactor pressure vessel and test it. So they came back and either they couldn't do the test or they didn't want to do the test because they knew the thing was embrittle. And Yankee Row never reopened. And the mothers now have the same lawyer, Diane Curran, who won the Yankee Row case, is now the lawyer filing this legal petition.
And the part that I forgot to say is that upcoming, we mentioned this earlier, Harvey, in October, Unit one reactor is going down anyway for maintenance, for refueling. And our petition demands that, number one, they hold a hearing about it. And number two, that the NRC order that it not be allowed to come back online until they have taken a sample out of the reactor vessel and tested it. And now the interesting part about this is that PG&E anticipated this back in April, and they filed with the NRC an exemption. They said, well, we might not, we're going to try to get a sample out of the Unit 1 reactor vessel when it goes down for refueling, but we might not be able to get a sample out. So if we can't get a sample out, can we postpone it till 2025 and then wait 18 more months to get the results back? And we are saying, no, you can't. You can't do that. You cannot restart that reactor until we've got the results in hand. If it turns out it's perfectly fine, well, it's perfectly fine, but it's not perfectly fine.
Well, if it isn't perfectly fine, we can anticipate that they'll change the regulation of what's acceptable embrittlement so that it becomes perfectly fine. Lucky for us, we have the great Kevin Camps with us, who is truly an expert on this from Michigan. And Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, you're the top expert on Palisades. Is it true that the NRC said that they looked at Palisades and they said, well, Palisades isn't embrittled, therefore Diablo Unit 1 isn't embrittled. Is that a narrative that came out somehow?
Well, like Linda said, back in 2013, we kind of had the NRC cornered on all this stuff, and we kept demanding that they provide us a list of the most embrittled reactors in the country, and they finally did. We turned out like 120 people onto one of their webinars. We got the webinar in the first place by pressuring them. So we kind of, you know, were holding their feet to the fire. And so the list they came out with had Palisades and Point Beach, Wisconsin Unit 2 tied as the worst embrittled in the country. So Lake Michigan is wedged between the two worst embrittled pressurized water reactors in the country. And then Indian Point Unit 3 was the next one, worst embrittled. Thank God it's closed. It's being decommissioned as far as we know. And then tied for the last two of the top five worst would be Diablo Canyon Unit 1 and Beaver Valley Unit 1 in Pennsylvania. So that was the list. What you just said, Harvey, about regulatory retreat. I mean, the Associated Press, an investigative reporter named Jeff Don, did a four-part series after Fukushima. It was called Aging Nukes. It was focused on the U.S. And the top example that he gave of regulatory retreat in the United States was pressurized thermal shock, embrittled reactor pressure vessels. So this, as you said, has been going on for decades. I think the lesson that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry learned after Yankee Row was we will never let that happen again. And so they have devoted themselves for the past three decades to not let that happen again. There will never be another reactor shut because of these risks, these particular risks. But they've even worked it into the 20-year license extension processes, the 40-year extensions out to 80 years. They're rumoring 100 years. What they do is they come up with a methodology that makes it all better on paper. And when reactors can't meet one methodology, they're allowed to try another methodology. And it's all fine on paper until it's not. And an example I'll put out there is Japan post-Fukushima. The most embrittled reactor in that country was called Genkai Unit 1. And yeah, they had their hypotheses and everything looked fine on paper until they pulled a sample. They pulled one of these capsules and they looked at it. And it was way off the charts bad in real-world physical data. Which is why there's all this hemming and hawing and delaying and postponing and canceling. They don't want the data. They really don't want the data because what if it's off the charts bad? So the response in Japan after Fukushima was Genkai Unit 1 was shut down immediately. No more discussion. It's dangerous. Shut it down. It was one of the, you know, dozens of reactors shut down post-Fukushima permanently. Thank God. So in this country, we've got kind of a different situation here. It's where these reactors can do nothing wrong. We don't want to see the data. And, you know, congratulations to Mothers for Peace. I've read the first 30 pages of the filing, and it's really good stuff. And, you know, listening to the filmmakers, listening to Linda just now, I'm just kind of amazed by the similarities between Palisades and these California reactors. Mm-hmm. At San Onofre, the similarities of putting high-level waste on the beach in faulty dry casks, which, you know, believe it or not, Palisades is also at risk of earthquake danger because they really didn't build the place, especially the dry cask storage, with earthquakes in mind. And what do you know, there's an NRC whistleblower, Dr. Ross Landsman, now retired from Region 3, who's been pointing out since the year 1994 that the dry cask storage at Palisades is in very serious risk of earthquakes, because what could happen is the beach could part, the lake could flow into the breach, and the casks could find themselves on the bottom of Lake Michigan. You really don't want these things underwater. They're not designed to cool that way. If water gets into the heart of these things, you could have a critical mass of uranium-235 and plutonium-239 that have formed in the accident. You could spark a chain reaction because of the water moderating the neutrons. It would make emergency response a suicide mission. The waste would be overheating. If there's any leakage, it would be made all that much worse into Lake Michigan. That's one difference between San Onofre and Palisades, is Lake Michigan is the drinking water supply for tens of millions of people downstream. And then the similarity on embrittlement between Diablo Canyon Unit 1 and Palisades is another similarity. So, you know, where Diablo Unit 1 was supposed to shut next year, and I hadn't really realized about the 13 years or the 16 years they'd recaptured on their license. That was kind of news to me. They've done similar at Palisades. They recaptured, you know, the construction period, for example.
Right.
So these reactors should have been shut years ago, decades ago. But nope, they're still going. So the fight at Palisades is getting more and more serious. Where Diablo was supposed to close next year and the year after, Palisades, you know, originally was supposed to close in 2007. Then they got a four-year recapture of the construction period. We fought them on the 20-year license extension, but we lost. So that now they were good to go out to 2031. That's where the license is now. But we've learned that Holtec, in its restart scheme, we're calling it a zombie reactor restart scheme. Sure enough, they're not going to go through all this bother to just operate till 2031. They're going to go for another 20 years. That will take it out to 2051. And, you know, what just happened, which made the news several days ago, was that unfortunately Holtec has found a buyer for the electricity. These two rural electric co-op networks, one in Michigan called Wolverine, how clever, the other in Indiana called Hoosier, how clever. And it turns out that Wolverine got burned on Fermi Unit 2 decades ago. They got gouged. They were lucky they didn't get worse gouged, but they got gouged. They should have learned. They haven't learned. They're now in bed with Holtec. You've got the safety risks, which are off the chart. You've got the gouge to come in the form of a power purchase agreement that's way above market rates. The reason Palisades was closed last year by the previous owner, Entergy, was the power purchase agreement between Entergy and Consumers Energy, the original owner, which led to charges on ratepayer bills up to 57% above market rate. It ended last year from 2007 to 2022, a 15-year power purchase agreement that was gouging the rate base in the area ended. And Entergy was like, our joyride is over in terms of this gouge on ratepayers. But Entergy has known about these dangers. They knew about the dangers of acquiring Palisades before they did so. They didn't make any of the fixes that Consumers Energy said needed to be made in 2006. The lid, the steam generators, the reactor crusher vessel, the list goes on and on. So here we are in this predicament where the safety risks can't really be overstated. The risk to pocketbooks would also include all these state and federal bailouts. The state's already given $150 million towards the restart scheme. They'll probably give another $150 million. The feds are poised to give a $1 billion nuclear loan guarantee under the Inflation Reduction Act. But I don't think Holtec has given up on that same pot of money that Diablo accessed, the civil nuclear credit program at DOE. That would be another $1.2 billion from the feds. So the restart scheme bailouts are $2.5 billion. But get this, Holtec has also announced they want to build four small modular reactors at the Palisades site. Another $7.4 billion in nuclear loan guarantees. We're now talking $10 billion in public bailouts at the Palisades site. Are they going to invoke eminent domain and take the state park and take the Palisades Park Resort community to build four more reactors on that site? So all of this is in play. It could all culminate in a decision by Halloween, which is so appropriate and appreciated that Holtec would choose Halloween as their decision date on the restart of the zombie reactor. So we're thinking about doing our second annual Zombies Against Palisades, or ZAP for short, with an exclamation point on the end. We showed up as zombies at the state capitol last Halloween, and we're thinking about showing up this Halloween. But it is some scary stuff. These are nuclear nightmares, no joke. So that's what's going on out here.
Oh my God, it is truly astounding. I want to point out in terms of earthquakes that the first reactor in the United States that was actually physically damaged by an earthquake was in Ohio. the Perry nuclear plant in 1986, just when the Challenger blew up, Perry was hit by an earthquake. The governor at the time, Richard Celeste, took the NRC to court demanding that they not reopen, that they actually Perry had not been opened and they were pushing to open it. And Dick Celeste asked the federal courts to not allow Perry to open until there was a study of the evacuation planning in light of the earthquake. And the federal court turned him down and said, and let them reopen, even though there was not a restudy of the evacuation planning, which is, of course, another issue. The other nuclear plant in the United States that's been damaged by an earthquake is North Anna in Virginia, for God's sake. So, you know, we always think of the earthquakes on the coast, but an earthquake in the mid, well, the biggest, actually, the most powerful earthquake fault in the United States is the New Madrid fault, which goes right up the Mississippi River. So, you know, this earthquake issue is not limited to the coasts. And I got to point out, of course, the Palisades is shut and they are now pushing to reopen it. Is that correct, Kevin?
Yeah, Entergy shut Palisades on May 20th, 2022, 11 days earlier than planned. And the reason, in addition to all the safety systems I've already mentioned, was the Palisades has had control rod drive mechanism seal leakage since 1972. They've never determined the root cause. They've never fixed the problem. They do Band-Aid fixes. So that's another pathway to meltdown at Palisades. So in addition to all the risks that we already knew about before they shut down, you've now got the risk that Holtec has not maintained the plant. They have not actively maintained the steam generators. They've not even turned the turbine generator. So that thing is bending under its own weight. And some of you may remember Christmas Day 1993 at Fermi Unit 2 when their turbine generator suffered a mechanical explosion and sent 500-pound chunks of metal at high speed crashing into various systems, including cooling water, which then flooded the basement, got radioactively contaminated, and they ended up dumping 2 million gallons of radioactive wastewater into Lake Erie before they got permission to do so. And then they pretended like they got permission, and they got permission, and then they said they dumped. They'd already dumped. So those are more risks at Palisades, that they haven't done active maintenance. And you can't just flip a switch, but that seems to be kind of what they plan to do, and we'll see what happens.
Well, speaking of maintenance, at Diablo Canyon, the deal to shut Diablo Canyon was signed in 2016. You know, Governor Jerry Brown, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, the California Public Utilities Commission, the state legislature, the various regulatory agencies, the local governments, the unions, the environmental groups, except for the mothers, all agreed that they would, in 2016, that they would operate until 24 at Unit 1 and 25 at Unit 2. And Pacific Gas and Electric, which owns the two reactors at Diablo, stopped doing maintenance, for God's sakes. They said, well, we don't have to fix this stuff because we're going to shut. So for the last 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, the last 7 years, they haven't been maintaining this place. And we all know what PG&E's record is. In 2010, they weren't maintaining their gas lines in San Bruno, and the gas lines exploded, and they incinerated 8 human beings and 19 houses, to which they pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter. And then in Northern California, in 2017, they weren't maintaining their power lines, and they set the whole place on fire. They burned down the city of Paradise and killed more than 80 people. I mean, this is a mass murdering criminal that's running Diablo Canyon, and they haven't been maintaining the plant at all. We don't need the power, and we're not. It's not clear. You mentioned at Yankee Row, they did not have little coupons, and what these little pieces of metal, and at Diablo Canyon apparently they did, which they insert, and then when the refueling comes, they pull them out and then they test them. That's the idea. But they haven't done that at Diablo Canyon since 2002, for God's sakes. And go ahead, Linda.
That was because when they tested the coupon in 2002, they didn't like the results. It's just like what Kevin said. you get those results, it shows that a reactor vessel is going to be brittle very soon. What they do is they get an exemption. They go and look at a coupon from another plant, or they do these calculations, mathematical calculations that show that it's everything is hunky-dory. And that's why it's so great that we have gotten this terrific expert witness. And by the way, the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee has also, because of we have been bringing up this issue of embrittlement with them, they have also hired an embrittlement expert. So our hope is that their embrittlement expert will confer with our embrittlement expert and that they're both really interested in finding the truth instead of, you know, covering up for PG&E. We'll see what happens.
Well, one thing we can be certain of, no matter what, well, first of all, we don't know how long it'll take them to test the coupon if they in fact pull it.
We do. There's a new kind of test. It's called the nano indentation test. The old test took 18 months. That was called the Charpy test. But this is a new test called the nano indentation test that's been used at, that was developed at Berkeley. And they can take a very small piece of the sample and test it many, many different times so as to create a database that's reliable about it, because they say, oh, they have so few samples that they don't have a reliable database. Well, they can get a reliable database now. And the results of that nano indentation test are like, you know, I don't know how long, like an hour or a day or something, very timely.
Okay. Well, the one thing we can be sure of is that no matter what the embrittlement tests show, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will say it's safe.
Right.
Whatever their current regulations are, and however bad it turns out, the NRC will tell us it's all perfectly fine.
That was the esteemed veteran activist Harvey Wasserman, Linda Seeley of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, and Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear. Note that this is only part of Harvey's call, and we will have a link up to the full recording if you want to hear the full 2 hours. There will also be links up on the website to the Mothers for Peace petition and pro-nuclear materials engineer Digby McDonald's declaration about the containment system at San Onofre and its embrittlement. Note that during the call, there were a few references to a new film on San Onofre by Mary Beth Brangan and Jim Heddle, both of whom were earlier participants on Harvey's call. They will be the featured interviewees on next week's Nuclear Hot Seat, where they will be talking about their masterpiece of a film, SOS, San Onofre Syndrome, which will premiere in October. It's so good, I'm busting my brains out waiting to get all the information to you.
Activists, shout out.
Last Saturday, September 16, there was a call for a global candlelight vigil against the dumping of the radioactive tritium-contaminated wastewater from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, and it truly was international. I was able to participate at the ocean in Santa Monica, thanks to the support of longtime activist Sukuru Force for the invitation to speak. And we will have a gallery of photos, just a few, from some of the places that have reached out and sent their pictures to Nuclear Hot Seat, which includes pictures from Korea, Indonesia, Australia, and the wilds of Santa Monica, California. There will also be a video up of the 10-minute speech that I gave on what's really behind the problems at Fukushima and what we are up against in terms of media manipulation to get our message across. That's at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 639. The Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists invites you to attend a virtual skills building workshop on how to make an effective call to Congress. It's called After Oppenheimer, Learn How to Call Your Member of Congress, and will take place on Wednesday, September 27, between noon and 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We will have a link up for how you register on our website under this episode. This is a great training where organizers will go over tips that can boost your call's impact during the training. And Hanford Challenge has a new resource page for Hanford workers on the presumption of illness law. Advocates for Hanford workers hear all the time about how difficult it is for them to get compensation when they get sick. And other workers talk about how scary it is to report a concern at work. Because of this, Hanford Challenge created a resource page on topics like whistleblower protections and how to report safety issues anonymously to help Hanford workers and their families. We will have a link to it up on the website, along with all the others. And here's an ask. Next week is my birthday. And as a present to me, you know, I've got this book on Amazon called Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. If you've already bought the book, thank you. If you haven't, please do. And either way, go to the Amazon page and write a 5-star review for me. I've learned that once a book gets 50 reviews, Amazon provides it with additional promotion. I've already got 40, so if just 10 of you write a review, a good review, I'll get free advertising and a big boost on the Amazon algorithm. If I manage to get to 100, they will blast it out. And all of this is at no cost to me and no cost to you. And you don't have to write a literary masterpiece. If you say, this is a good book, that's just fine. It's the number of reviews that counts. So if you can, go to Amazon.com, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, and of course we have the link up on the website, and say something nice about the book. It will help get the information out much further than I can reach by myself. In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 19, 2023. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, it's the easiest thing in the world. You can, of course, sign up on your favorite podcast platform, because we are everywhere. But the best way to do this is to go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big honking yellow box that shows up when you first go to the site. Fill in your first name, your email address, and you will receive an email with a link to the show and a brief description of its content every week, just one a week. I don't bug you. We don't sell it. We don't do anything icky with it. We just get the information to you as fast as is humanly possible. It's the best way to guarantee that you never miss a single episode. Here's another way you can help. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all will assist us, and of course, your support is deeply appreciated. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and hey, throw my name into the mix as well. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, nuclear is forever. And last time I looked, not one of those in charge of it is God. So they should stop pretending they know what to do with eternity and shut the damn things down. There you have it. You've just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.